Okay, here we are. Last lecture. Well, sort of. This is the last official lecture. There is an optional review session on... I'll save this so you all can see it. So there's an optional review session. I should say optional. On Friday, 2 to 3... On Friday, 2 to 3:30, in SC 103, that's in the Stacy building. Does anyone know that room? I don't think I've ever used that room. It's tiny. It's supposed to fit 140. It's cramped. Well, we'll see how many people show up. I booked it for 140 was about the biggest room I could find on the ad hoc booking thing, and I'm guessing about two-thirds of the class showing up sounds about right, but we'll see. It might be really crowded. It's possible. But anyway, I will record the audio and video from that lecture, so because I'll actually probably be going through code and things, so that will be on Friday. Assignment 8 and 9 solutions are already posted if you look at the wiki. Look through them, let me know if you have any questions or anything. Assignment 10 solution will be posted on Friday around the time of the exam, of the review session. Assignment 10 is due today, but you can turn it in without penalty till Friday, so if you haven't turned it in yet. So the final exam is on Tuesday. That is a Tuesday, April 14th, isn't it? Where's my mouse? There we go. Yep, it is, yeah. You have another exam I'm giving on Monday, so. Yes?
What's the last thing you can bitch about at Marks? Like, can I get extra, points for my assignments if I feel like there are points removed for no reason? Like, what's the last day?
Okay, what's the last day?
Yeah.
So, I have 10 days after the final exam to calculate things. Now, to let you know, I'm going to drop the lowest tutorial. I'm going to drop the lowest assignment. And if you do better on your final exam than everything else, that will bring up your grade. The standard marking scheme is designed for those students who are going to be consistent workers. That you, if you consistently put in your assignments, consistently put in your do the tutorials, then if you mess up some on the midterm and final, those will help bring your grades up. But for those of you who are a little more inconsistent but can pull it together at the last moment, you'll do fine too. But you got to pull it together. So it's a higher risk strategy. I, in general, don't advise you plan on that. But sometimes you get to the end of the semester and that's what you're relying on. So I understand that. So I'm all for the Hail Mary pass. So. But the nature of this class is that it's not something that you can cram for. It's something that you've got to have been doing the work and figuring out the pieces, parts, and building the conceptual model in your head. Hopefully at this point things are relatively clear. If they aren't, try to get some help. So another thing this week, I will be around. I'm not going anywhere. I'll be around the rest of this week. So if you need to come by office hours, the TAs will not be having regular office hours, but I'll be having extended office hours. So if you have things you need to discuss, tell me. If you have grading issues with the tutorials, you should email the TAs. I think I'll just have to post a list of who you should contact for each assignment. But the basically assignments, I'll post that later. But if you're wanting to, if you're concerned about wanting to make sure your grades stuff, you can do it this week or you can do it next week. So you can do it after the final. Just do it by the end of next week. I'm not going to have the grades done. I mean, at the earliest, I'll have my grades in by the end of next week. If I do, I'll be going, yay me. So, okay, that's the main admin stuff. Then, as I promised, I was going to talk about picked up. So, when I say the future, how do you understand the future? You have to understand the past. So I'll talk a bit about the past, I'll talk about where we are, and trying to say, okay, you learned all this stuff in this class, where does it fit in the world? What are you going to be doing with it in terms of web technology and stuff? So let's start before the web. There was the internet. Anyone know when the internet started?
1987.
87? Anyone else? So, it depends on how you define it, but basically early 70s. You know, it's something old. I can actually show you my distributed operating systems class. I have some, let's see, let's remember the copyright for, okay, let's, yeah, Resource Sharing in Computer Communications Networks, 1972. You should watch this video, The Heralds of Resource Sharing. It is hilarious, mainly because it looks like the early 70s, classic geek attire and everything, it's wonderful. But they're talking about the internet. They're talking about the design of this thing. They're quite talking about TCP/IP, I don't think that was a little later, but all the pieces, parts are there. So the internet's been, what I'm trying to get you is the idea of the internet's been around for a long time. And it was built over multiple decades. But this web thing, late 60s. It depends on where you do it, but web is 1993 on. So the web started about two to three decades afterwards. Right? That it took a while for the web to come along. So what was the internet before the web? Do you know what the internet was like? What did you do on the internet? So before the web, you had LAN protocols, and you had WAN protocols. So local area network. Local area network protocols, things like NFS, so we'll say file sharing. There are many others. LDAP, I was saying like directory services. I'll say yellow pages. I'll say YP. It stands for yellow pages. LDAP's a little later. That wasn't kind of the first ones. Telnet. Okay, and then remote login. Log into another thing for a terminal, so RSH, Telnet. Well, RSH is really a LAN protocol. And then WAN protocols, WAN protocols, you had file transfer, FTP. You had email, SMTP. And remote login, Telnet. So, do you know the difference? So the difference between email, so email is point to point. Goes from one email server to the other. It's a store and forward protocol. The idea is that originally you would actually have to specify the path of how your email would be transferred. So you would say, okay, my email would go to the Carleton mail. So let's say I want to send an email to, say, to Berkeley or something from here. So I couldn't send email directly to Berkeley. I would have to send it via here, and then maybe it would go to the University of Chicago, and then maybe it would go somewhere in Colorado, and then maybe it would go to Berkeley. And you'd specify each of these things, these bang paths with exclamation points. And then people figured out, well, we can do it directly. But email is older than some nice bits. And then file transfer, that's just FTP. You log into a server, grab stuff. We had this thing called anonymous FTP where you logged in as user anonymous, and then you could you didn't have to type in a password. Well, you typed in a password of your email address to kind of say, yes, it was me, so as to be nice to the system administrators, know who's accessing their stuff. Remote login, you can telnet in to type commands at a command prompt. So what I realized here is that certainly in the 80s, you had the remote desktop kind of things, the X protocol, X Windows, that started in the late 80s. That predates the web by at least 5 years, if not more. So you have email, you have file transfer, you have remote login, you had things like NetNews. What was NetNews? Think of email. Well, think of your bulletin boards. Think of a web board or something, except that you had your own local copy of the web board. Instead of the messages you going to a central server and getting what message was there, they would be passed around between NetNews servers. I mean, this still exists. You know, NetNews still exists. Now you really have to pay for access to the servers because the feeds that are there are gigantic, but essentially they all replicate each other. So it's like almost like a decentralized web board, but using your own custom clients as opposed to using, you know, just like you're using an email client, you're using your NetNews client. Anyway, why am I mentioning this? I'm mentioning this because the internet existed before the web. The internet was very useful before the web. But if you look at all of these things, they're all a bit geeky. I mean, see, they're things that someone with a knowledge of computer systems would find very useful, and someone without a knowledge of computer systems would probably find kind of like, ooh, okay. I mean, the file sharing in a LAN protocol, okay, you kind of had work groups and stuff, but then people wouldn't understand that. Yeah, that doesn't tend to work that well as it scales up. WAN protocols, anonymous FTP is a pretty bizarre protocol for people if they aren't familiar with computer stuff and you get and put and stuff. Email was finding some use. I mean, if you look at the commercial services, things like CompuServe and such, yeah, CompuServe, AOL, how could I forget AOL? What were they basically doing was they provided internet-compatible email, often combined with their own applications. But it was all inside their environment. So the web. So why was the web created? Hypertext. It was about there are lots of other attempts at hypertext. I mean, there's Memex. I might be wrong, but I have to correct that. What's his name? Von Neumann's, John von Neumann's idea for text. Then the Xanadu, which was Ted Nelson's dream, which he tried building for a long time, and it never actually took off. But then there's other systems like Gopher. There were a lot of other systems that were trying to do this whole hypertext thing. And they, you know, they succeeded in stuff. What was different? What was different about the web from these? Well, a couple of things. One is markup. Is it more, say, rich? Believe it or not, a lot of the other systems that were trying to do hypertext were really about text. They didn't do things like, it might have had a little bit of like bold or something, but they didn't have, images. Pictures! Yes?
How did you connect to a website?
How'd you connect to a website?
There was no IE.
Yeah, there was.
There was?
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole idea of the web, well, so for all of these things, you have to remember for every single thing you have, when you're talking about the internet, what you're talking about is you have some program that speaks the protocol. The program that speaks the protocol. Like, to do Telnet, you have a Telnet client. To do file transfer, you FTP, you have an FTP client. Email, you have an SMTP client. You know, whatever it's Outlook, Eudora, Thunderbird, whatever. Net News, you have a news client. So same thing with all these things. To do, Gopher Waze, you had a Gopher client, you had a Waze client. And for the web, you had a web client. Does anyone know what the first web browser was created actually on NextStep by Tim Berners-Lee. So everyone knows that your next step's still around, right? Okay, so you're going to talk about the history of the web. I've got to at least talk about next step briefly. Next. This was Next. Next made these beautiful workstations in the late 80s and early 90s. The neat thing about them is they were graphical they were Unix workstations that had really pretty interfaces. Next was a corporation founded by a guy named Steve Jobs. You might have heard. Why did Steve Jobs found Next? Because he got kicked out of Apple. John Sculley and other people kicked him out of Apple. And so he went off to the woods and founded Next Corporation. And Next made beautiful hardware that was way overpriced, but had really, had really great, aesthetics. Let me see if they have a nice screenshot of this. Okay, yes, that doesn't look as pretty. They looked much prettier back in the day. But here, there's a screenshot of the Next desktop. So you notice it had this nice, even today it doesn't look that bad. I mean, nice, icons. Kind of text and things and stuff. This is, this was like 92 or something. The original Next Step was all monochrome, like four levels of gray, I guess. Recycling icon. So it was a beautiful system, but it wasn't, it turns out it was really good for rapidly developing graphical applications. So Tim Berners-Lee, so where did this find a niche? Swiss bankers. They were willing to pay the money in order to develop in-house applications that were easy to use and good for doing things like trading commodities. Then also, Tim Berners-Lee at CERN, they had these things lying around. They use it for prototyping the first web browser. Because you can build a nice graphical application. So just to know how this connects here, Next Step was bought by Apple, but really that was kind of a reverse takeover. That was Steve Jobs coming back to Apple when Apple was in really bad shape. And what did he do? Apple didn't have a next generation operating system. They didn't have an operating system that wouldn't crash when surfing the internet because it didn't have protected memory. That's bad. So what they did was is they took Next Step and turn it into Mac OS X. So whenever you hear about iOS is Mac OS X with some slight changes. So when you're running an iPhone, you're running an iPad, you're running Mac, you're running Next Step. How can you tell that Next Step's still under the hood? Because you, if you've ever seen a little spinning rainbow icon on a Mac, and you're waiting, that was from this. Also, if you look at the core objects of when you're the Cocoa objects, when you're programming iOS, you're programming Mac OS X, it's the prefix, the two letters that start most of those objects is NS. Next Step. The core, so when people talk about software and they talk about where does it come from, the thing to remember is that it's like archaeology. I mean, there's just layers on top of layers on top of layers. And we now live on a software edifice that goes back like 50 years in parts. You know, the stuff for, you know, the whole Apple thing goes back to the, you know, late 80s. And that stuff was built on Unix, which goes back to the early 70s. So that's why it's important to understand the past to understand where things are going in the future. So what did the web get right? It basically got two things right. So the other two things, it had a really simple protocol. I'll say this browser. Browsers were relatively simple in the sense of what they had to do. Now, of course, web browsers are not, but hey, you stick a couple of decades on something, things get complicated because we kept going to do more things with it. The initial web browsers, relatively simple. There were a number of early web browsers. People would just sort of create them all the time, but then, and the protocol HTTP was really servers so you could have make it easy to create servers or things that were talking. So I would say that's what the web, well, and then also it was stateless. What it meant is the server didn't have to remember anything about the client when it connected. Now it's all of our HTTP commands, the gets and the puts, when I say, what did the server do in response to a get? What did the server do in response to, you know, to a post, you just look at the get request. You just look at the post request. You go like, is this related to any past gets or posts? You look at the request. Oh, look, there's a cookie. But it's up to the server to decide whether it wants to pay attention to cookies or not. That's it taking on its own burden for remembering state between web clients. Otherwise, it could just ignore them. And that's what enabled web servers to scale. It's like, okay, now I've got a whole bunch more customers coming to my website. Let me just replicate my front-end web server. And they don't necessarily have to synchronize. And if they do have to synchronize, they synchronize via the back-end database. But initially, the web didn't have anything like back-end databases. They just had files. That's what HTTP was about. Also, they had So what is it? So they had pretty markup. This was the HTML. They had images. They had things were simple to implement, scalable servers, and they had these thing called URLs. So URLs were neat because they provided a way to uniformly name resources, and this mattered because this is a URL except it's missing the beginning part, the HTTP:// Nowadays, we just sort of leave that off because everything's HTTP. But back in the day, you really needed that thing in the beginning because it wasn't necessarily going to be HTTP you were talking. Early web browsers, and even I think the current ones, although I'm not sure, spoke the other protocols. FTP you can. I'm not sure if you can put Gopher in anymore. So you could say Gopher:// or you could say FTP:// Or you could say, you know, HTTP. So web browsers started making their mark because like, oh, you can browse the web and we can show you all that stuff, but we can also access all the old stuff too. And the way you do it is by specifying the URL of the resource. And the URL was URL was the protocol host name, and then whatever other stuff you want to give to it. And that's the way, and so that provided a uniform way of unifying the web's resources via one client, the web browser. So the web was found in the beginning about marking up information, making it pretty, and being universal. And those trends have only continued. But what was the evolution of the web since the first web browsers? So let's just look at Mosaic real quick. That's not what I want. There we go, NCSA Mosaic. So this was not the first web browser, but this was the first web browser that was really commonly used. And this became the basis of... God, that's kind of fuzzy. But this became the basis of Netscape. And Netscape begat Mozilla. So the direct line for there. So what should you notice about this? You should notice things like, oh, look, there's a URL bar. Oh, look, there's a page for content. Oh, look, there's a menu. Oh, look, there's buttons for things. There's a back button and things. There's a reload button. There's a little thing that would, this globe would kind of spin or something when you were loading a page. It's a web browser. It's what you'd recognize. Still same basic design is still around. What's improved? This looks a lot fancier. The main part of the page looks a lot fancier. In other words, we've learned. So what's so some key technologies. So one is CSS. Layout matters. CSS is prettier pages. Got JavaScript, dynamic pages. Now, originally JavaScript came on the scene pretty early, as in like Netscape implemented it in like 1995 or something. So, because they realized, oh, let's actually make our documents a little fancier. Let's make little animations. Let's have little drop-down menus or something. How do we allow people to modify that, control that? We can't just do it through HTML. We need to be able to program it. So, they created JavaScript. So you've got CSS, JavaScript. What else did we get? We had plugins to extend the functionality of the web browser. Like Java, Flash. Silverlight. There's been a whole bunch of plugins, but those are basically gone. They're going away. I'm getting to that. I'll get to that in a second. So basically you have CSS. You have JavaScript, you had plugins came and went, and then So I said now the kitchen sink is what's also coming. Basically everything is being put into the browser now. Initially we had CSS, then we had JavaScript, and then we had video chat. sockets. What? Huh? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. In your you know, location, touch, you know, new inputs. WebGL. So what is this? So what's happened is we got CSS and JavaScript. We then had plugins to try to extend the functionality of the web browser to do other things that we felt they might want to do. And then we kind of said, give up on that. And so instead we started creating standards for a lot of different technologies. And this has been happening over the past 5 years at an increasing, accelerating rate, meaning that essentially any kind of application you potentially want to build is becoming buildable inside of a web browser. I mean, you want to build a Skype-like thing. Oh, now there's a standard for that. Oh, you want to just do, high network communication, do that. You want to do, touch, of course, that came along. You want to do graphics, that's come along. I mean, it's just, you name the thing you can do on the desktop, we now are getting web standards for doing that. But all of those things are kind of little pieces, parts, that are kind of add-ons to this core of HTML, CSS, so when I say they're within this framework, I'm saying is they are implemented as new HTML tags, they're implemented as maybe as new CSS things, maybe implemented as functions you can call from JavaScript. They're all within that framework, extending it to enable you to do new things. So what happened was we got this platform that was Turing complete, that could do all kinds of stuff, and then we decided we want to do everything on it. So, why? Why bother with this? Why are we keep putting everything in here? Because almost always trying to shoehorn various things into the web framework is in some way non-optimal. It would be better potentially to have them be implemented separately. Maybe a web browser might be able to use it, but why not just do it as a completely separate thing? But no, we tend to build upon these existing technologies. And the reason why is actually pretty simple. I think the easiest way to say it is just once you have a universal platform, it sucks the oxygen out of the room. And you might have remember before the universal platform, before the web, what was the universal platform? Windows. Windows was a universal platform. You had niches for doing various other things, but otherwise, what was the default platform you wanted to implement stuff on? It was Windows. Before Windows, it was kind of Unix, although Unix never was kind of completely unified, but certainly that was kind of the standard thing. And in fact, Unix has kind of come back a bit as a universal platform. But really, the universal platform is the web now. You implement things via the web because it enables you to go everywhere. I mean, what are the problems that happen that if you ignore the universal platform? You have things like, okay, how are people going to adopt this? So how do you adopt the things outside the universal platform? You have to get people to download your program. You have to get them to implement that. You have to get them to, we're getting a little bit of a resurgence of downloaded platforms in terms of, mobile apps. So we are getting this appified, but a lot of mobile apps are really just wrappers around web technologies. And the trend is that I think potentially to get rid of the apps and they'll just be again just web pages, but they'll use the web stuff and you won't have to actually install anything except maybe to bookmark it. I'll explain that a little more in a second, but network protocols. Let's say I don't like using HTTP as my transport protocol. I'd rather use something else. I'd rather have something else. Well, if you want to just go completely on your own, you have to deal with the simple fact that there's firewalls that block, and a lot of places, most protocols. I want to get into major enterprises. How do I get my stuff into a major enterprise? I could try going by a regular network protocol on whatever port, and it'll just get blocked. How do I get in there? I have to go through their web proxy. How do I go through a web proxy? I gotta be speaking HTTP. Otherwise the proxy won't work. So do you all know one of the reasons why Skype became so popular? It was because it was very good at getting around firewalls. It's actually really funny to see Skype work behind, at least old Skype. I'm not sure how much Microsoft has compromised this with after they took it over. But the old Skype, when you put it behind a corporate firewall, it would sit there and try to figure out, how do I get to the outside world? And first it would like try to talk its own protocol and things like that. And eventually what it would say is, I'm a web client. And it would start shooting out all these web connections that will go right through their proxy. And it would pretend to be web traffic, and it was actually Skype. And it turns out it could be very stealthy. There actually was a large market for a long time on ways to detect Skype. Because Skype would potentially consume huge amounts of bandwidth, especially inside larger organizations with very fat pipes. Because when you ran a Skype client, it was actually a peer-to-peer protocol, and all of a sudden it would become a supernode, which means it became the router, so now hundreds or thousands of people's calls were going through that one node. Oops. Network administrators do not like this. But how did it do this? Because it decided to pretend to be a web protocol. That's what everyone does now. They pretend to become a web protocol because that's what everyone expects on the web. Sex on the internet is a web protocol. You have web protocols and you have legacy protocols. Or you have proprietary protocols. When you do, you can do web, you can do sockets now with the newer protocols, socket.io. But then you're expecting to talk to the same thing on the other side. Normally, your code on both ends. So, short way of saying that, a universal platform sucks the oxygen out of the room. Everyone wants to get on it because it's just easier. To fight against it, you have adoption issues, you have compatibility issues, it just bites you. And that's what the status of the web is. And what's really interesting about this is the web is a platform that is controlled by no company. Because it's controlled by no company, I think it potentially has much longer longevity than things that have come before. In fact, I suspect whatever the future platforms will be evolutions of what the web is. They may look very, very different, but the pieces, parts will be there when you look underneath the scenes. So to a first approximation, what's the future? The future is the past. The future is the web. The web is going to continue. The technologies you learn in this class are not going anywhere. They may get superseded in various ways. The HTTP 1.1 is what we talked about in this class. There's a new protocol, HTTP 2, that's coming along that's binary and faster and other things, but still it's the same protocol. It's just more efficient on the wire. Because why is it basically the same protocol? Because they want to make it easy for existing web applications to adapt. If they change the complete semantics of it, then no one would adopt it. It has to be a very smooth transition. Say, use this and you get better performance. So yeah, so web protocol, so HTTP is getting better. In the browser, it's getting better. You're getting more and more tags, more and more protocols, and now you can do video chat. Have you all seen the latest Firefox that like says this hello something? I haven't played with it, but basically it's talking about the real-time chat support, video and audio chat support in the latest Firefox builds. They have some sort of branding associated with that, but it's, I think, just WebRTC. So lots of things are coming up, you know, coming along, but it's all based on the same stuff. So you might go like, well, you know, the web's kind of old, it's kind of crufty, you know, JavaScript has got those weird things, you know, that double equal sign is all weird, and, you know, you all saw how the scoping things, and there's all these, like, problems, you'd say, with the various web technology. I mean, refer is misspelled, I mean, what is with this? I want something better, I want something new. Evolution works, not revolution. Revolution, every time you try doing the revolution in the context of the web, you fail. This happens again and again. Now, why do I say this? So, what's one of the most hated things on the web? Well, first off, Flash. Flash was coming along for a while, seemed like it was kind of doing this, you know, taking over things, and Flash then died. Flash died because it was proprietary, so no one else could extend it, no one else could fix its warts, no one else could adapt it to different use cases. Adobe tried keeping up with it, and it failed. Well, first before Flash, it was Java. Java applets, again, were too inflexible. Flash was too inflexible. There are lots of glitches there. And then people kind of say, well, you know, I really hate JavaScript. I want something better. You know what the latest heir to the throne of that is? You know what Google had? They said, we don't like JavaScript, we want something better. So you know what they created? Dart. Dart was supposed to be a more modern, proper language, more in the school of, like, with proper classes and proper static type checking and, you know, better performance and all this stuff. It's just compiled to JavaScript now. I mean, it started off being compiled to JavaScript, but then they thought, well, people should build Dart runtimes into web browsers. Then we can all have the beautiful stuff of Dart. And they tried doing that, and they realized no one else was going to adopt it other than Google, and then everyone else was going like, I already have to maintain a JavaScript runtime, now I have to maintain a JavaScript runtime and a Dart runtime. That sounds like a pain in the ass. So they just stuck to JavaScript. And yeah. So these technologies are not going to go away, but they will get better. There's lots of efforts. So for example, JavaScript is evolving, HTTP is evolving, there's ECMAScript. ECMAScript is the name of JavaScript in the standard organization land. So ECMAScript 6 is in process, and it's got lots of nice new features, fixes some of the, deals with some of the warts in a backwards compatible way. There's, HTTP 2, which is improving things. CSS is constantly evolving. Browsers get better with standards compliance. We're getting this better platform, and then there's, of course, all the standards for extending the browser with different technologies. But then what about everything else? What about every other technology? All of those other languages you like, C and C++ and Java and Pascal, Lisp, whatever. Every other language you might want to program in. What about those? What are all the other technologies you might want to use? If the web's here sucking the oxygen out of the room, what do they do? One is, run it on the server. You might notice there's real convergence on the browser side. Remember I talked about there only being four rendering engines? Blink, WebKit, Trident, and Gecko. That's it. That's all the ones that can render. And two of them are very close to it because one's a fork of the other. And Trident actually now there's, what is the Spartan browser? They fork Trident, and now Microsoft has forked Trident, and they're trying to clean it up and make a better rendering engine. But anyway, that's Microsoft. They can afford to have their own rendering engine. But it's a very big piece of technology. So not many people can afford to develop it. But on the other hand, on servers, how many different server frameworks have you heard of? We'll talk about the plethora in a second. But basically, you run it on the server, or either run it on the server, or you translate it for the browser. So what do I mean by that? I thought I had mentioned this before. Did I talk about ASM.js? I feel like I mentioned it. ASM.js is a subset of JavaScript. It is legal JavaScript, but essentially it's assembly code. It's a subset of JavaScript that's designed to be a compilation target. Just like you have a compiler targeting x86 instruction set, or targeting MIPS, or targeting ARM, or something, you target ASM.js. So you compile to JavaScript. What can you compile to JavaScript? Anything. Specifically, Scriptum is a LLVM to JavaScript compiler. It takes LLVM bytecode. So LLVM is this, basically it's a compiler collection. It supports C, C++, LLVM in fact is used by Swift, Apple's language. I mean, it's all you name the standard compile language, there's some sort of support for it, probably LLVM. The LLVM compiler infrastructure project. So let's see now. Open projects. So CLang. Yeah, VMKit project implementation of a Java virtual machine. C++. Yeah. It's got all kinds of stuff. So anyway, if you can get it to if you can compile it to LLVM bytecodes, then you can compile it to JavaScript. So, you want to take the Unreal game engine and you want to run it in a web browser? It's written in C++. How do you do it? You take it, compile it to JavaScript, run it in the browser. It works. It's even pretty fast. That's what's crazy about it. It's like within a factor of two. So you want to play with whatever technology you want, just go ahead. You want to run it in the browser, just cross-compile it to JavaScript. Even high-performance stuff. So that's how you solve it one place. The other way is you do it, is you do it on the server. Okay. I just wanted to see if I could show you comparison of web application frameworks. Oh, yes. So, take a look at this. Comparison of web application frameworks on Wikipedia. How many ways can you program a web application? Notice the languages. I'm just going to scroll. If you're listening to audio, just go to the comparison webpage. Basically, you name your technology staff the way you like to program. People have made a web application framework that fits your style. Because programmers have lots of different ways they want to build things, and so they do this thing. You name your programming language. I mean, for every interesting programming language, there's multiple like Python. Look at all the Python ones. Look at all the PHP. PHP, of course, is one of the most common ones. Those tend to get a lot of use because PHP is very common for a web server. But, you know, you name your language, it's there.
Mm-hmm. You're saying I compile something like Quake and the .executable can become a .html page?
It would be a JavaScript document.
That run in
an HTML page, yes. Yes. You can take Quake, compile it using mscriptum, and run it on a system. Well, so using mscriptum, it'll compile the JavaScript. It'll run in any browser that supports JavaScript. If you have mscriptum compile it to the asm.js subset, it will run in any browser, but it may run slow unless it has explicit asm.js support. If it has explicit asm.js support, it will run wicked fast. And in fact, all major browsers are starting to support asm.js. Certainly, Firefox has been the pioneer behind it. Google Chrome is also supporting it. Now, Google also has these things called native clients. Google doesn't like this. Google doesn't like JavaScript. They keep trying to get around it. So they have an alternative to saying, instead of asm.js, let's get rid of this whole JavaScript thing. Let's have a... They have native client. Oh, that's so funny. There. The Wikipedia page is a sandboxing technology for a subset of these things in a native code sandbox. So native client is becoming particularly popular right now because Google is using this as the technology for running Android applications within the Chrome browser. You might have seen this in the news sites that now you can run your Android app inside Chrome using this thing called Arc Welder. So that's kind of cool. It's doing this and stuff. I'm not saying this technology is going to go away or anything, but I'm saying this is not going to be the dominant technology. And the reason it's not going to be the dominant technology is because everyone has to build a JavaScript runtime anyway to run the web. Why am I going to run two runtimes? Why do I want two sandboxes for running code? Why not just run one? Because it turns out you can get everything to run in one fast. And then you only have to worry about making sure it works once. Now, what you could have is say, I'll put my entire web browser inside native client and there'll be sandbox and stuff. And anything's possible, but I think of this as going to be much more of a... I don't think this is going to be the future. I think the future is something much more closer to ASM.js because, again, it's evolutionary. It's incremental change. It fits in with what everyone else has done. It means everyone else has to do less work in order to adopt it. Even though it's maybe not quite as good, it's good enough. But the web frameworks. So clearly, what I have shown you in this class with the Express web framework running on Node.js. So let's go up here. There is a JavaScript list, and okay, these are giving. They're not even giving Express on here. it's a smaller one. Maybe I should just put in an edit for that. But anyway, you see, there's all these. I think this is just. These are really just more talking about client side things, Angular stuff, but. Oh, I wonder if Node's here. No. Anyway. So many frameworks, this isn't even a complete list. If you want to use this technology, one of the other ones, you certainly can. But the main interaction pattern you have of having to support specific HTTP requests, gets and posts, having to basically do the routing for them, having to use some sort of template language to generate HTML and then send to the browser, having to send JavaScript to the browser, having to send CSS files to the browser, having connections to a back-end database, having to deal with concurrency issues. This is all universal. This is what every web application framework has to deal with. They may do it in somewhat different ways, but the basic problems they have to deal with are the same, because that's what you have to do to support a web application. Deal with all those problems. So a natural thing to say is, which should you use? Am I saying Node and Express and everything is the best web framework out there? Oh God, no. It's not at all. It's good for certain, I think it's actually quite good for certain kind of applications, particularly ones where you don't do lots of computation on the server, because again, the Node server is single-threaded, so it's not designed to do a lot of computation in line. If you do a lot of computation in line, you're going to really make your web server work badly. You want to do quick things. If you have large computations, you should offload it somewhere else. But of course, that's what you should do always in a high-performance web server. And I think it's much better to offload it to a separate process than it is to offload it to a separate thread, because it keeps things cleaner in terms of the boundaries between the parts of your system. But that's my own opinion in saying how you should architect things. And there's a lot of other schools of thought. What I'm saying is Node is not a bad way of doing it, but it's by necessarily not the best, and it's not certainly not the best for all applications. So which should you use? How do you go about choosing them? Well, the good news and bad news is in practice you're probably not going to be choosing it. It's going to be chosen for you. Because you're going to go into an organization, and in that organization they're going to have an existing web application, and you're going to have to enhance it. You're going to have to modify it. You're going to debug it. So you're going to be working in an existing web framework. And you're going to go, oh my God, I wish I could use this other web framework. And maybe you'll get a chance to when they decide to rewrite their entire web system. But when they do that, be careful, because that any of those projects, if you have to rewrite an entire web backend, it's probably going to fail. Fail in the sense of it's going to take way too long to do. It's going to be over budget. It's not going to provide all the features they want. Because rewriting any application from scratch is almost always a disaster. Because again, evolution wins over revolution. Don't replace, extend. Refactor if you have to in order to keep yourself sane, but work with what you've got. Sometimes when you want to do something new on a new web framework, and then mesh it in, and then maybe you can slowly, incrementally take over the rest of the website. So for example, you want to add a new commenting mechanism. Implement it using something new or use some new different package. Glue it into the old framework and then maybe take over other parts of the website, as opposed to trying to do it all at once. Don't never try to do it all at once. It's like it's a car running and it's going down the road and you're replacing parts while it's on the road. It's a bad idea, but we always have to do it that way. So be careful, because you don't want to crash. So a basic rule of thumb, which should you choose? What you like. If you have the ability to choose things, go and choose it. Although, pick community over individual aesthetics. You want something that's going to be well-supported, because web applications tend to have long lifetimes, just like all code that gets used. It's going to be around for a while, so if there's an existing community around it, you have other people who help support it. Part of saying there's a community around it is pick open source. Don't pick a proprietary framework to build your, to die your fortunes to, because again, what happens when that company goes out of business? This is why Microsoft, you might see the talk recently go like, well, will Windows go open source? Maybe. It's because, again, people are realizing that if they don't have control over the code of their infrastructure, they're potentially doomed, because they want to need this code to live on for a long time. That's why they've open sourced parts of .NET, because they want that to be an infrastructure layer that runs everywhere. Microsoft will have their own proprietary technologies off of it, but people can have their own, they can have control over that foundation, because otherwise they won't use it. They'll use one that they do have control over. So I just have a couple of minutes left here. What what would I say? How does this connect to your future classes? So depending upon, some of you I know are second year, some of you are third year, some of you are fourth year. If you're later on, hopefully you already see some of these connections. If you don't see the connections, but if not, let me try seeing if I can expand it. So what classes are you going to be taking after this? Well, Comp 3000, which I teach. So this is about what runs a browser. what's the code that they depend upon? That's really what an operating system, that class is about. Then there's Comp 3007, really the big thing you should know is functional programming. You know this whole thing of passing, using functions as first class objects and passing them around and things? That's kind of one of the bases of functional programming. The other thing about functional programming, which is kind of there but kind of not there in JavaScript, is immutable data. So some data in JavaScript is immutable, such as strings, numbers, it means they never change, they always have the same value. But then you'd also deal with lots of mutable data structures, like objects. Objects are highly mutable. In a functional programming language, a pure functional programming language, everything is immutable. You never change the state of everything. And you say, why do you do that? Well, take the class, you'll understand. But basically, one of the big reasons is it can lead to great, it's great for concurrent applications. Because where do concurrent applications fall down? Synchronizing state. So, here you go. So real web applications often don't use things like MongoDB, which is just an object store. They use fancier databases that support things like transactions, that have more sophisticated, you know, queries, more sophisticated data, you know, ways of organizing your data, data modeling. It's worthwhile because you're going to probably be using databases in some form or another because, yeah, they're useful. So 3000, 3005, 3007... let's see now, what else is third year? 3004. So one of the things you should have seen in this course, which I try to expose you to, is that you have to be able to deal with programs. I mean, the programs we dealt with are actually kind of small, but they live within a universe of very large programs, and they relied on lots of functionality coming from them. So in 3004, you start building some larger programs, but more importantly, you start dealing with the whole software engineering concepts around these larger systems. And also, I mean, I think whether you succeed or fail in a course like 3004 is whether you can read code. If you can't read code, what you end up doing is rebuilding code from scratch because you can only understand the code that you've written, and that means you never understand the code of your teammates. Reading code means being able to read the code of your teammates and being able to understand it and fit it into what you have, being able to critique it. So we started reading code here. In 3004, you're reading a lot more of reading code. And if you don't treat it as a course in which you do a lot of reading code, you're not going to do well. Because that's part of teamwork. And then there's all the courses that build on top of this. This, you know, the security stream is also, you know, interesting for this. There's distributed, you know, distributed systems, distributed operating systems, artificial intelligence. You know, there's a little bit, but those all. I'm just talking about the required course in third year, which I think is this is the main. Oh, then 3804. So why do you care about 38 to 4? Because it's the foundations of everything. So, I mean, to understand, well, in particular, why do I think it's useful? Is because you have to be able to see the patterns. So when I talk about programming languages don't matter, I'll translate from this to that and other things. The reason we can do all that stuff is because of the ideas that you learn in the theory stream. That's what gives you the basic understanding of computation. So you can say, oh, look, yeah, that's the same as that. And you look at all these different programming languages, you realize they're all doing basically the same thing. So the future is the web. Internet of Things is going to be the web. It may not look like the web, but it's going to be the web underneath because these technologies don't go away and they're too useful. So I hope you learned some of the stuff in this class. It should come in handy. And hopefully you'll figure out how to mesh it with everything else you learn. And I will stop there and hang around here for questions. But thank you. Okay, before you get up, hold on 1 second. Yep.
Are you going to talk about the format of the exam for you to have these
sessions? Yes. But you saw the midterm. Same format.
Okay.
The thing I have to do, I have to finish, I'm going to try making the exam for Friday. And what I'm planning on doing is taking the code for assignment 10 and cutting it down so I can fit it on the exam. And that's what the test is going to be based on. So I'll show you that code hopefully in the review session. Because the entire assignment 10 is too big, so I've got to cut it down some. So. But it's basically going to be that kind of thing.